It's very good to be here again this evening. I don't know how many of you are new to Buddhist practice, or how many of you are old warriors. I'll try to speak this evening in a way that is accessible, useful to people of all ranges of experience. I was asking Gil when he invited me to give this give a talk this evening, and I asked him if there was any particular subject he wanted me to speak on, and he didn't really come up with a subject as such, but he said, well, I've been talking the last few weeks about concentration, and so I'm not quite sure why, but then he said, well, you can talk about whatever you like. So I don't know why, but the thought that came to mind was that, well, if they've been spending a lot of time focusing on concentration practice, then maybe it would be interesting to talk about, you know, who it is that's doing all the concentrating. Mm-hmm. Or who is it that's a Buddhist or meditating or whatever. It occurred to me just to make that the general theme for the evening, the issue of self in Buddha Dhamma. Because of all the things that might seem to be real in the world, even if we have serious doubts about the solidity of various things in life, perceptions and ideas and material possessions, the world itself, we might have had insights or kind of mystical experiences of one kind or another, showing us that that things are not as solid or as real as they seem. But the one thing that seems really, really indisputably real is me. I mean, not me, Ajahn Amaro, but I'm not quite such a megalomaniac. But the feeling of self, it seems to be a kind of an inarguable verity, because whatever's going on in life, whatever seems to be happening, certainly it seems to be happening here, and it seems to be happening to this me. Is that right? I mean, is that a common experience? Right, okay, so far so good. So even though that, notwithstanding that that seems to be so true, so obvious, you then, arousing an interest in Buddhist teachings and Buddhist meditation, you then come across this this principle of anatta, or selflessness, not self. So then, and it depends which Buddhist books you read, and how they're phrased, but oftentimes the way it gets put across is that, you know, the Buddha taught that there is no self, that we don't have a self, and that that's actually the feeling of self is the cause of all the problem, and that once we realize that we don't have a self, then all our troubles are over. So there's a kind of seems to be a conflict of realities here. You know, on the one hand, we feel like we're the most sort of real thing in the universe. On the other hand, there's this, you know, extremely respectable spiritual authority seemingly telling us that we don't exist. And so, you know, what's going on? And also, things are phrased in different ways, but that can be perplexing. Sometimes we take the idea of not-self, and that seems to really appeal to us. And say, oh, that's it, you know. And various different philosophers, I think it was either Locke or Hume, I forget which one. I think Hume, who felt that the human condition could be boiled down to just the experience of a flow of perceptions. So that's all you could say that was happening. So, so that you can take that as an idea, or the idea that, you know, so it can seem that, oh well, it's true, there is that, you know, that there's no one really here, or I don't exist. That the idea of Buddhist philosophy all hangs together and seems to make a lot of sense. Then we take the idea of not self, and then we go around saying to people, I don't exist, or you say, or even worse, you say to them, you don't exist either. By the way, I can see there's a lot of people coming down. But would it be better if I sat up on a chair? Would that make it easier to hear? Yeah? Okay. Could you pass the chair? Kind of buried down here. Yeah. Okay. Okay, great. That's fine. Could move that away. Okay, that's a bit better. I can see everyone now. So it's, I thought that'd be helpful to just talk a little bit about what the principle of anatta is, how it works, or what it's about, or how the Buddha used that in terms of his teaching. Because primarily, the Buddha's teaching is not a belief system. That he didn't say put out a set of ideas or principles and say, okay, I'm telling you this is true, and if you and you should believe what I say because I'm totally enlightened and I can't get anything wrong, and I'm saying this, so therefore, you know, you should take it on trust, you should believe me. But far more, he put out, even though he said at times, well, this is how I see things, this is the way the universe seems to me, the way the mind seems to me, this is how it looks from my side, this is my understanding. But primarily what he wanted to do was to pass out the tools whereby we could discover things for ourselves. Even to the extent where one incident that my own teacher Ajahn Chah used to like to quote regularly was where the Buddha was giving a Dharma talk, and he expressed some principles that he had never spoken of before. And then at the end of the talk, he turned to Sariputta, his chief disciple, and said to him, have you ever heard this teaching before, Sariputta? And he said, no, I haven't. And the Buddha said, well, neither have I. This is completely new to me as well. Sometimes that happens, you know. Just as you're talking, insights kind of manifest. And so then the Buddha said to Sariputta, "So do you believe that what I said is true?" And Sariputta said, "Not yet." So then, now, this is really striking, because you'd think, well, here you are, you know, in a public situation, and you turn around to your kind of chief assistant, and you are supposed to be totally enlightened, and he's supposed to be completely enlightened as well. And so then you say, do you think what I'm saying is true? And you'd expect that your side man would say, oh yes, indeed, Lord, you know, absolutely, you know, how marvelous, how wonderful. But then the Sariputta says, no, not yet. And the Buddha says, well, why not? And he said, well, because I haven't seen it and experienced it for myself. And the Buddha praises him and says, good, Sariputta, good. This is exactly how it should be. That even though, you know, I am a fully enlightened Buddha, and you are my chief disciple and have complete faith in my insight, and you know that I cannot speak anything which is not true, still it is correct practice, that you should not believe this until you have seen it for yourself. You should not take this to be true until you've seen it for yourself. So, with that in mind, you know, when you pick up a teaching like anatta, what's helpful to understand it is not as a kind of proclamation that we're expected to believe in, but a tool to explore the nature of experience. So all of the what are called the three characteristics of existence, anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, transiency, dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, incompleteness, instability, suffering, and anatta, selflessness, teaching of not self. These are not beliefs, these are not principles to be believed in, but tools to explore our own experience. So the way that the Buddha used anatta was to investigate the feeling of selfhood. And what he did was, rather than saying, you know, there is no self, in fact, several places, he says, to take the idea that there is no self and just to believe it, to grasp that idea, is wrong practice. It's a wrong understanding. Because what we're doing is just taking an idea and holding on to it as an absolute truth. He actually pinpoints that. So even to say that, you know, is a wrong understanding. So what the way he uses it instead is to say, in the way he's presenting it, is to say, the body is not self, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self, mental formations are not self, consciousness is not self. You cannot. When you look at the body, at the world of form, of feeling, perceptions, and so on, what's called the five khandhas, that there's nowhere in any of that of those configurations can you establish an absolutely true sense of me and mine. This is me. This is what I am. This is myself. This belongs to me. I am the owner of this. That you can't find anything solid. Or in fact, look and see. Can you find? Is there anything within this that is absolutely me, absolutely mine, absolutely who and what we are? And so it's a way of saying, looking at our experience of ourself and the world, and sorting through it, seeing, and then by using that principle of checking, is any of this myself? Is this body myself? Well. If it was myself, then you know, surely that quality of self would be stable. It would be whole. It would not produce unhappiness. And then you see, well, actually, you know, if I take it to be myself, you know, even the body that we came into the room with has changed, right? Bits that you called yourself. When he walked into the room, I won't get too gory, but let us just say carbon dioxide that was floating around in your blood when you came in the room has since been passed around and has been breathed in by a few others and breathed out again, and various kind of dust particles and bits of clothing and other kind of airborne body parts. We pick them up, we breathe them in, we acquire them. So, and this is, even as I'm speaking, this is happening, right? This doesn't kind of stop just because we're thinking about it or talking about it. So what you have with the idea of not-self is more a strategy for investigation, investigating how the feeling of I grabs hold of the body, grabs hold of memory, of feeling, of personality, grabs hold of ideas and emotions, it grabs hold of just states of mind themselves and forms what seems to be a solid absolute entity. But what we're doing with Buddhist practice, and particularly with insight meditation, is looking into that feeling of self and recognizing, oh, well, that which I thought was really me was not actually me. That we see that the body, the feelings, thoughts, they're ephemeral, transient, empty, void of substance. They're mental events that come and go and change. That's all we can say about them. Now, the Buddha deliberately took this, in Christian theological terms, they call this an apophatic, I won't get too technical, an apophatic method. And that means you assert something by negation. So the people get very irritated that the Buddha didn't say, well, what the self is. He just says, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this. Or if you look at the body and feelings, perceptions, etc., then you can't find the self anywhere. So then people are irritated because it's like, well, okay, well, define for us what the self really is then. Come on. Is it some kind of transcendent essence that's sort of everywhere? Or, what is the Atman? What is the Atta? How do you define that? But the Buddha really kept to this method in many, many different respects of his teaching. And the reason why is because as soon as we have an idea for something, we tend to hang on to the idea rather than stick with the reality. So the Buddha saw in his time in India, and as has been going on ever since, we'll create an idea of God or an idea of ultimate truth, an idea of reality, and then we hang the idea up on the wall or build a shrine around it, and then we worship the shrine and totally forget the thing that it was describing. That we very diligently carry around the reminders, but we forget to let ourselves be reminded. You see what I mean? So that he felt this was such a crucial element, and I guess he saw around him that was so prevalent. People spending a lot of time and energy defining metaphysical truths, defining what ultimate reality is, the nature of the absolute or the nature of God or whatever. And then, okay, now we've got it, we fixed it, this is the right expression. This is the wordage that says it perfectly, okay? And then what happens is that the mind kind of clamps on that and says, okay, we say it's this, it's Brahman, or it's Allah, or it's Jehovah, or it's the goddess, or we say it's the great whatever it is. And then, of course, what happens is you kind of, as you say, okay, now we've got it, now this is the way, this is the true expression, then of course in that very holding onto the expression, then the other expressions get devalued and externalized, and then you find yourself, even though you're on one level adhering to or trying to adhere to the most high and pure principles in existence, what you end up is on the emotional level is kind of fighting with other people like you're a kid in the schoolyard. And I think we've probably all of us seen this happen, particularly those who've been in the academic field, that in the university world, it's really amazing how you have people who've been studying philosophy or theology and this kind of refined areas of spirituality for like decades, and arguing about the nature of ultimate truth like 2 8-year-olds kind of rolling around in the schoolyard, kind of saying, it's like this, no, it's like this, it's like this, no, it's my dad's tougher than your dad, my dad's going to come beat your dad up. And on an emotional level, it's just like that. It's kind of totally lost the very source of it. So the Buddha refused to go into that at all. And left his emphasis at, if you stop identifying with what you are not, then what is real will become obvious. All you have to do is stop creating the obstructions to the reality. When the obstructions are not there, the reality will become obvious. And that reality cannot be cast into concept or word. So he was really strict in never going beyond that barrier of metaphysical reality. When he did make metaphysical statements, he'd say things like, there is Nibbana, it's worth realizing. There is an ultimate reality, it's good. That's about the extent of his metaphysical kind of. He got very unpoetic when it came to metaphysics. He kind of just, that's it. Just like get, he can bring you to the border and just kind of point you, and that's it. So just cross the border, and then it'll be obvious what's the truth is. So that's what the teachings of Anatta are trying to do. They're trying to just say, they're pointing out that which is not self for us to discover in our own minds. The feeling of selfhood that clusters around different qualities of our nature, and then being able to use insight practice to penetrate, to see through that, to be able to let all those different areas go, and then to reveal what the true Dhamma is, what the true nature of reality is. It's like by a process of elimination, like not this, not this, not this, not this, not this. Now we if we live in a world of ideas, we actually find it very, very hard to live with the having eliminated all the ideas and the concepts, living with that empty, that kind of undefined quality is really difficult, because we always want to get a name or a quality or an idea or a pattern to kind of fill that up. But I'll get to that later. But that in itself is a major issue. So in Buddhist tradition, the way the Buddha spoke of things, he said there's two different levels of identification that we experience. So the first level is what's called Sakkaya Ditti, or the personality view. So this is where there's an identification with the body, with our character, our, whether we're introvert, extrovert, whether we're female, whether we're male, whether we're old, whether we're young, whether we're artistic or musical or mathematical or energetic or practical or diseased or whatever. So all of those very familiar characteristics, when someone says, you know, well, what do? You know, you don't usually say, I am. I don't do, I am. You know, only if you're really... So P.J. Proby was famous for giving that as a reply to a reporter once. Someone said, what do? He said, I don't do, I am. But most of us, when someone asks, what do? You say, oh, I'm a programmer, or I'm a school teacher, or I'm a Buddhist monk, or, yeah, you know, I'm retired, or I'm a gardener, whatever. We give an occupation, or something of that nature. So the personality view is like talking about that, the kind of obviousness that with which we pick up those characteristics. Well, of course, you know, I'm a woman, of course I'm a man, of course I'm English or American or whatever. I mean, so it's not arguing with the conventional reality, but it's saying this is actually just a convention. That being a man, being a woman, being old, being young, having, you know, this occupation, that occupation, having different characteristics, these are actually conventions. They're just judgments that we make, the way that we can describe things. And that it's seeing through the personality view is like recognizing, oh, these are ascribed values. Well, these just refer to a part of what we are, but they don't refer to all of what we are. So, and again, just to stress, this is not a belief system, but this is say an insight that arises through our own investigation. So for example, you can you know, looking at the body, you can say, okay, you say, oh, I'm a man or I'm a woman. Okay, so then you can then consider, well, which parts of you are male and female? You know, the air that you just breathed in, is that male carbon dioxide, is that male oxygen or female oxygen? At what point does it acquire a gender? Right? Okay. Presumably, most of you have something to eat today. Right? So then, at what point did that piece of lettuce or the mouthful of bread become male bread? Or when did the carbohydrate in the bread turn into a man or a woman? You know, I mean, in a way, it's a kind of a mind game, but also it's like that that statement, says, well, of course I'm a, you know, of course I'm a woman, of course I'm a man. It's like, okay, well, where is that? You know, how does that work? What is that construct? Does it apply all the time? I mean, I find, you know, when I sit down to meditate, and it's not like my mind being in a state of complete absorption or anything, but, you know, it's quite easy to forget that even if you're a person, you know, your mind concentrates on the breath or the physical sensations. You know, I totally forget I'm a monk sometimes. You know, it's like you're just sort of with that one particular aspect of your being, you know, the flow of thought or hearing a sound, you know, a physical sensation. Is that a monk sensation? You know, when I hear a car going by in the street, is that, or just hearing you laughing, you know, is that monk laughter? You know, it's happening in a monk's ear, so is that kind of monk sound? Yeah, is that kind of monk kind of action potentials hurling down the neurons? Is that monk electricity going through my nerves? You know, where is that? And so just picking up and looking at all those areas of what we take to be absolutely obviously true and see, well, it's only partially true. Being a layperson, being a monk, being a woman, being a man, being old, being young, being smart, being stupid, you know, being healthy, being sick. You know, that we just begin to see that the patterns that we create are transparent. So this is what we mean by personality view, and so that at the first level of liberation, of enlightenment, then this is what is understood. Personality is one of the three things that are seen through with what's called stream entry. So, and it's not as though you kind of, again, it's not like grabbing the idea and saying, oh, I'm not anything, you know, I'm not a man, or, you know, I'm not a person, or, you know, again, it's like there's this guy who used to be part of the, I think he's died now, but he was a part of the British Buddhist scene. There's this ancient Buddhist institution in London called the Buddhist Society, which is a kind of Victorian gentleman's club. So the sort of epitome of armchair Buddhism. I don't think you ever had armchair Buddhism in California, but this was founded in the 1920s by a high court judge called Christmas Humphreys, and he's a famous Buddhist writer. Yeah. And so there was this fellow, every year they had this great gathering called the Buddhist Society Summer School for a couple of weeks. And this chap used to be one of the people who went along. And he was very enamored of the principle of anatta. And so he would always refer to himself as it. His wife was admired as a saint on account of this. But he was, you know, he would say things like, you know, it's hungry, Doris. I think you ought to put some food into it. You know, which is very well-meaning, but it's taking the idea of not self and making it into self. You know, so it's like, you know, close but no cigar, as you'd say in this country. So that so this is really the first level of self for us to see through, and then much further down the track, probably many of you have had this kind of experience, say in retreat or in some kind of isolated moment, or sometimes in sort of spontaneous experiences that we can have where suddenly everything falls away, and you can clearly see, oh look, it's this body is not mine, or this personality is just a costume that is worn. You know, I put it on when I need to be the father, I'm the father. When I need to be the child, I'm the child. When I need to be the kind of the teacher, I'm the teacher. When I need to be the student, I'm the student. Oh, it's just, these are just costumes that come and go. There's nothing there. Aha. And in our clear moments, sometimes when everything falls away, often if we're kind of alone out in the wilds, away from other people or on retreat, and the kind of self-constructions fall away. Even though that can happen, and the insight can be really clear, oh, that's not what I am, the feeling of I am can still pertain. You can't say, we definitely know I'm not the body, I'm not the personality, but the feeling of I am is still very strong. So this is called asmimana, or the conceit of I. Asmi means I am in Pali, mana is conceit, so it means the conceit of I am, the conceit of identity, just the very feeling of I-ness and me-ness, my-ness. So this is like at the very last level of, it's not until the very last level of liberation, arahantship, that this is really kind of seen through and dropped completely. So this is sort of deep tissue material, as it were. People can talk about deep tissue in such abstruse areas. But it's a significant area to understand, because it's like the kind of last barrier, and that there's a kind of wall often that we hit in meditation, where there's definite kind of insight into the emptiness of internal and external experiences, but there's this feeling of the observer, that there's a watcher, there's me here watching all this happening, and there's all this happening here and now, and it's known by this observer. So the feeling, the subtle feeling of I and me and mine, kind of clusters around that. So that then, this level of liberation is like, is what we need to do is actually just like seeing through the very feeling, the sense of I. And as you begin to experience this now and then and see it more and more clearly, you begin to recognize that the feeling of I, the feeling of self, is actually just like, it's just a feeling. Just like the force of gravity. I mean, like you don't kind of walk around, get up in the morning and think, oh, you know, gravity's pretty strong today. Or like, oh, fancy that, I'm stuck to the earth. Look at that, isn't that amazing? You know, how? Yeah, incredible, the car is staying on the road. You know, it's an extraordinary thing. You know, my hair full, well, my hair doesn't, but you know. But my robe's going to hang downwards, you know, rather than floating. You don't think, oh, how amazing, how extraordinary, how come that's happening? You know, gravity is totally ordinary to us. You know, we don't think of like female gravity or male gravity or my gravity or your gravity. It's just there. So the feeling of I is just like that. It's just a kind of an inarguable presence. But just like gravity is actually a conditioned phenomenon, right? The only reason why we experience gravity is because we're on a planet. If you go off the planet, there's no gravity. Gravity does not actually exist. We don't feel it unless there's a large body that this body is being pulled to. We wouldn't notice it. So it's caused. It's dependent. And the self is exactly the same way. So like noticing the feeling of self is just like noticing gravity. It's not something that's obvious, but when you pay attention to it, it's like, hey, right, I weigh a lot. This thing is pulling me the whole time. And it's only when you get old, or you get sick, or the body doesn't work well, or you're trying to climb up a hill. It's like we live on a kind of 1 in 3 slope. Our forest monastery climbs 1,500 feet from one side of the monastery to the other. So gravity is a very prominent experience for us. But it's like when you're tired at the end of the day, you've got a 500-foot climb up to where you live. So it's like, oh, right. So it's when we notice, hey, this thing weighs a lot. There is weight. So self, in exactly the same way, it's like when you turn your attention to it, the feeling can be pretty obvious. But there has to be, to really notice it, there can't be a lot else going on. It's like gravity, you know, if you're busy kind of working with the traffic or trying to deal with people on the phone or talking to your partner or whatever, watching a movie, you know, gravity doesn't grab your attention. So in exactly the same way, it takes a clear and focused observation to really notice that feeling of self. But then when we look closely and investigate, then it's, oh look, that's it. the feeling of I and me and mine, and that feeling of self is not self. Just like the sound of a car, or the texture of cloth on your skin, or the sound of my voice, that the feeling of self is just as much a part of the whole fabric of nature. It's just a factor of the whole natural order, just like anything else. And it's not self, just like anything else in nature. It's just part of the whole pattern. And again, just to stress, this is not something to believe, but that we can look at for ourselves. In meditation, this is why we use the kind of meditation on inquiry, like they use in the Zen tradition in Korea, in China, in Advaita Vedanta, they use the question, like in Korea, they use the question, "What is it?" Or in China, they often use the question, "Who is mindful of the Buddha?" or "Who am I?" Similarly, in Advaita Vedanta, they use the question, "Who am I?" And that these are meditation practices, they're skillful means whereby, when there's already established a clear concentration, a clear stability of life, and a well kind of integrated practice, then when the mind is clear and focused, when you ask the question, "Who am I?" or "What am I?" what is the self, what is it that's knowing, that what happens at that moment is like flipping the camera around onto the photographer. And usually the photographer is the one who's never seen, like Henri Cartier-Bresson. There are no photographs of him. He would never allow himself to be photographed. It's not true. There's one book which said portrait of Henri at his home. You kind of finally to get to see what he looks like, and there's a picture of an ankle disappearing behind the French door. So it's like sometimes getting to see the feeling of self is like catching Henri, unawares. So, but this is what this kind of question is for. It's turning the camera around to look at the subject. Because meditation can be heavily involved with observing and dismantling the nature of the object, but actually missing the feeling of the quality of the subject. So this kind of question is like, "What am I? What is it? What is it that's aware?" And it flips the camera around to look at the subject. And so in that moment of asking that kind of question, or even making a statement like, "I am," or something that's obvious, like, "I am a man," or "I am Amaro." Even though something is an obvious truth like that, what happens in all these different cases is at that moment, the presumptions that we make about what we are get punctured. When you really ask the question, "Who am I?" in a clear and focused mind, "Who am I?" for a moment, the whole self-creation process collapses, and the word "who" sounds ridiculous. But it's not really a "who," it's more of a "what." Because already, subjectively, we're recognizing that there's this awareness which has no dimensions, it has no shape, it has no form, it has no texture, no quality, no color. And then, but we've turned it into a "who," like it's sort of a bubble of personhood. But, well, that's not it. And the heart recognizes, "Oh, that's not it." And so, when you ask these kind of questions, you ask them not to get a verbal answer. In fact, all verbal answers are wrong. Mm-hmm. I'll give you that clue to begin with. It's not like there is no right verbal answer. But what you're asking these kind of questions for is to interrupt that flow of, "I'm this, I'm that, I'm this, I'm that, I'm this, I'm that, I'm like this, I'm like that, this is who I am." It's like, that's not it. In that moment of seeing, we recognize that's not it. So to be able to interrupt that flow and to just let yourself rest in that space, that spaciousness, when the habitual sense of I is dropped, and before something else flows in to fill that up and create another identity, just to let the heart rest in that openness. At that moment, there's awareness of truth. there's the mind is completely awake, there's peacefulness, there's clarity, there's utter simplicity, no sense of time. And the aim of Buddhist practice, in pretty much all, ultimately in all its dimensions, is to realize that very quality of when the feeling of self drops to pieces, then the reality that is revealed. And as soon as the thinking mind jumps in and says, oh, that's what I am, I'm universal timeless awareness, that's me, or whatever, oh, I'm the ultimate reality, great, or, you know, I am nothing, I'm the great nothing, I'm the laughing zero, I am nothing, you know, you lost it again. It's just, but it's kind of the point of it has been missed, that the kind of the thinking mind, the conceptualizing, creating mind has jumped in and created a form where essentially and ultimately there is none. So this is challenging, because the ego, to the ego, this is the end of the show. It's like game over. You know, I'm no longer in charge. This is, and so the ego gets very, very upset at this. And so what often happens when that kind of insight is formed or takes shape is that the first experience is the first second or two is like, oh, wow, great. Great. And then the ego sets in with its kind of panic reaction, like, ah, now I really have to write this down and get the get the method, write a poem about it, or like go and do something to fill that up. Okay, now I'm totally free, I understand, great, now I can do anything, hey, this is great, I understand that I'm absolutely everything and nothing, therefore whatever I want to do is perfect, fine. Then the trouble really begins. So what often happens is a kind of egoic reaction kicks in, anything to fill up that space, whether it's beautiful or ugly, whatever, you know, whatever our habitual patterns are, something will be conjured up, you know, a new romance, an old romance, a new hatred, whatever it might be, just something. Or oftentimes in the kind of our Judeo-Christian conditioning will kick in and say, how dare you? You think you can just drop your guilt like that? You just say, hey, guilt has no owner, and that's the end of the problem? No. You don't get away with that. And but just to be able to say, to be able to listen to that, and in Buddhist tradition we say this is the voice of Mara. So, now I know, and the way you respond to Mara is not to reach for your gun, or you know, or argue, or fight. I know you, Mara. I know you. And just to recognize this is the kind of self-creating program trying to kick in, take over. So the last thing I thought I might say just before I open things up for questions, right? Usually have some questions? Yeah. So that there's also within the Buddhist field, there's this aphorism, and I think books have even been written with the title, you have to be somebody before you can be nobody. Well, this is not a teaching of the Buddha. The Buddha never said you have to be somebody before you can be nobody. He said things more like it's helpful to live a wholesome life and to focus your mind before you'll be able to have insight into being nobody, as it were. But you never get the teaching that, you know, that you have to have a strong sense of self before it can be let go of. So I can understand that people are saying, you know, you need to have a well-integrated life, and that you need to have a certain stability within your world before you can recognize the truth of selflessness. there needs to be at that well-integrated basis. But I think it's helpful to understand that, or to know that the Buddha never actually said that wholesomeness or that integration needs to be cast in the form of a solid sense of I. So it's more like what we in Western psychological terms you'd say is you need a positive self-image. It's more like that. But in Buddhist terms, the way that the Buddhist language would talk about it is the heart needs to be free from remorse and needs to be at ease. There needs to be a kind of basic optimism and gladness to be alive, a basic self-respect. Do you see the difference? Yeah. But there's no sense of and the use of I in reference to that can all along be clearly understood as just a conventional form, nothing that's kind of solid or absolute. But just when you say, how are you today? I feel great. There doesn't actually have to be any ego around it at all. It's just looking inwards, there's comfort, there's ease, there's gladness. No sense of self. But in conventional terms you say, I'm fine. But actually the I, in those circumstances, we can see as being transparent. So this is just a small point, but I think it's helpful to understand that the whole affirmation of the kind of egoic world, I don't think it needs to be quite as strong as it's made out to be. This is my personal shtick. But it's more like living in a way and cultivating wholesome qualities and living in a way that creates the causes for those bright, settled, well-integrated states of mind. So living virtuously, being kind of unselfish, being learning to be kind and generous and so on. Learning to not do things that just create turbulence within ourselves, not hanging on to needless anxieties. These create a basis for this kind of inner positivity. And then when we aim to then concentrate the mind, then the mind is much more easily focused. And when there's concentration, then insight can dawn. So I could go on, of course. But I'll stop the talk there and then open things up for some questions. You usually go straight into the question period?
Yeah. Usually we start at 9, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So if there's some people who need to go right now, then please feel free to go. But if people would like to ask some questions, then please do so. Yeah.
Is it the feeling of self that is false, essentially, or is the, let's say, there are 100 people here, but here and now, always, or not always, but just this instant appears from a very special place. I can't open my eyes through somebody else's eyes.
Right, well that's, in a way, this is the karma of being born. It's a kind of tricky understanding, because it's like, even though we might have the insight into selflessness and we can see, yeah, that's right, there's just, this isn't the person. It all seems to be happening here and now. So along with letting go of being, if you like, we also have to let go of here-ness and now-ness as well. Like letting go of time, and also letting go of place. So this is tricky to do when you have your eyes open and the sense world says, I am here, and my mind is here, the center of my world is here. Because that, again, seems like an obvious truth, right? And I found this for myself, that even after kind of years of after having got insights into selflessness and timelessness, there was definitely this sense of whatever it is that's happening, it's happening here. And it wasn't until a couple of years ago that I just began to notice that the feeling of here-ness was actually as much a construct as the feeling of self. And I don't want to get too abstruse, but if you notice the concept of here, or concept of place, only relates to the body. That you can't say the mind is actually anywhere, right? Where is your mind? Where are the edges? You know, you can't actually define it. Neurophysiologists can't define it. You know, meditators can't define it. And when you really reflect, you can see that actually it's only the body that three-dimensional space relates to. The mind is not actually connected to three-dimensional space. It's experienced through the consciousness happening within this body, right? The consciousness is sort of, this is like the kind of porthole, this is the kind of the screen, but actually you can't say it's anywhere. Like, a similar thing is like having an email address, you know, or a website. Where is the Abhaya Giri website? You know, it exists, it's got an address. You know, we have an email address. Where is that place? We say, where? Where's your address? And you say, it's, you know, this is the address, but where is it? You can't locate a website in 3D space. You can say, well, there's bits of data on, you know, held here and there, physically, somewhere, but you can't actually locate where that spot is. So similarly, it's not a perfect analogy, but it's in a way what is helpful to recognize is that the whole feeling of here-ness, of the life happening here, and thereby the feeling of our separateness from other people, is totally dependent on the body. And as you stop identifying with the body, and we begin to see the nature of truth in terms of mind, then we see, well, if my mind is not anywhere, it's not located in one spot, then, hey, what about all these other minds that seem to be located in all these other bodies? Somehow, there's got to be some overlap, or maybe it's the same mind, or, you know, and again, this is not a belief system, but as one starts to explore and open up to truth, we begin to experience. I mean, that's why the more profound our insight and the depth of realization is, the more the natural quality of affinity with all beings. It's because, and I don't like to say kind of we are all one or there's only one mind. I mean, because again, these are expressions that the Buddha didn't use. Or like one of Stephen Levine's expressions is the further in you go, the more you overlap. It's kind of a nice way of expressing it, but it's also, you know, all these expressions are not quite the truth. But what we experience is the more we let go of identification with the body and the personality and the sense of I, then the more absolute our affinity with other beings is. So that then compassion for others is as automatic as if, you know, there's a pain in your leg and your hand reaches for it. Because it's the same body. It's like, there's no second thought. It's like, oh, it's just my leg, you know. Well, why should my hand be interested? Right? So it's like, I haven't got my hand's busy. I haven't got time for my leg today. It's like, I haven't got time to be compassionate to you. Sorry. It's not, there's no possibility of that. So, I don't know if this is answering your question, but it's a helpful area to investigate, that actually when we let go of the body as the center of the universe and we just let the heart dwell in awareness itself, then that, just notice how much the quality of belonging and affinity is apparent. And it's not like me reconnecting. Even it's like the connection has actually always been there, but we've forgotten it or missed it because of the preoccupation with I and my world and my stuff and my routine and so on.
are still, somehow you can't get out of that format, right? You're always going to, not always, but at this one particular time, perhaps, you are looking for your experiences filtered to this format.
Yeah, and then in terms of the senses, that can be the case. But if you have a greater understanding, if the understanding is that, well, this is just, you know, Amaro's view on the world, because he's sitting on this in this spot, so he sees this. You know, if you see the relative nature of what's being seen and heard and sensed, and that there is this fundamental attunement and respect for all beings, then of course, you know, you can't look upon your perception of things as being any more realistic or valid or important than anybody else's. I mean, it's impossible. You can't, because why should what I think be more real than what you think? Yeah, so that there's a radical shift in, even though you see that, yeah, it's known through this particular avenue, there's the kind of partial truth of that, or the subjectivity of that is kind of very clear. And also, just like in meditation, as you start to let go of the preoccupation with the senses, particularly sitting meditation, sitting with your eyes closed, the visual world itself gives immensely strong cues. So that's why sitting with the eyes closed can be, you know, really helpful in like diminishing that kind of preoccupation with me here surrounded by you out there. That's why so many spiritual traditions, you know, you pray or you meditate with your eyes closed. So it's actually you're diminishing the cues that remind you that I'm separate and different from everything else. There's much more of a natural closeness in a way. Which is also why, you know, you kind of on a retreat you stop talking. Because we create ourselves through our speech and our actions, and that by and our interactions. So when you're on a retreat, you're just sort of like blob number 73, blob number 5, blob 84. It's like you don't have to be a school teacher or a computer programmer or a farmer or a doctor or whatever, or old or young or anything. You know, you don't have to perform as a personality, so that kind of the more root qualities of being can be recognized more easily. Yeah.
I just like to say I completely agree with you. I've done short silent retreats, and when you do those things, everybody stops talking, there's no identity, everybody just basically merges.
Mm.
And all the separation falls away. It's really neat.
And then the retreat ends.
Yeah.
So then you have the trick is the kind of the transfer at the end of it. Can you then do all the talking and seeing and moving and decision making, and still sustain that awareness of that fundamental quality? That's the trick. Because if you can only do it sitting on the cushion, then it's not worth much. Really. You know, if it doesn't transfer, then it's a very, very limited currency. You know, it's only valid in a very small republic. Yeah, you had a question. Okay, just last one. Huh?
What's the difference between the Buddha and the disciples that became enlightened after the Buddha?
Scripturally speaking, the Buddha was totally developed to the fullness of human potential, so that the depth of wisdom and the range of powers of insight and communication were vastly greater, so that he had extraordinary psychic powers, and also his ability to teach and to attune his mind to the needs of the listeners was much more acute. So you had some of the Buddha's enlightened disciples who were completely inarticulate, Well, like Sariputta, who was known as being the wisest of all the disciples, had no psychic powers at all. Zero. And others who had fantastic psychic powers who kind of missed their shot and made bad judgments regularly, or at least a few times. You know, kind of socially were a bit kind of missed their mark. So there's one incident that was often recounted is this. Some of the monks got really upset by this elder monk who seemed to be really kind of conceited and arrogant and was very dismissive to other monks and behaved in a really kind of haughty way and seemed to be very, you know, supercilious. And they complained to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, well, you know, you must understand that that he was a Brahmin. Not only was he a Brahmin in this life, but he's been a Brahmin for his last 500 lifetimes. So that when he talks to people who are from the, you know, monks who are from the kind of working caste or the untouchable caste or the other merchant caste, you know, if he seems to be looking down at you, he can't help it. There's nothing, there's no defilement inside. He just can't help the manner of his expression. There's nothing out of order there.
So enlightenment kind of like a black
belt. Oh yeah. So like a Buddha would be sort of ninth dan, black belt, ne plus ultra. That's the kind of textual definition. Okay.
Thank
you. Okay. Go well. Oh, by the way, definition. Okay.